From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Jonathan Kozel about life in one of America's largest temporary shelters for the homeless. Kozel has written a new book about homeless families in America. Also today, I talk with rock musician and producer T-Bone Burnett. After producing records for Elvis Costello, Los Lobos, and Roy Orbison, he's just put the finishing touches on his own new album, The Talking Animals. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Cho Lang Lin performing Mozart violin concertos, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the double talk of modern warfare. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. It's easy to be shocked seeing homeless people sleeping in cardboard boxes on the sidewalks of America's cities. Equally shocking is the living conditions of the homeless who are out of sight, living in abandoned houses or squalid shelters. Jonathan Kozel has written a new book about homeless families living in a New York City shelter, the Hotel Martinique. It's one of the largest welfare hotels in New York, and Kozel says it's difficult to do full justice to the sense of hopelessness one feels on entering this building. He interviewed many families there over the course of 2 years. Jonathan Kozel has written several books about the have-nots in our society. His 1964 book, Death at an Early Age, described his frustrations battling poverty and bureaucracy while teaching in a Boston inner-city school. His recent book, Illiterate America, focused on the 1 out of 3 adult Americans who are crippled by their inability to read. His new book about the homeless is titled Rachel and Her Children. It's excerpted in this week's New Yorker magazine. I spoke to him from station WAMU in Washington, D.C. I asked him why he first went to a New York City shelter for the homeless.
Well, I didn't go with any ideological predisposition. I simply picked up a copy of the New York Times a few days before Christmas in 1985, read a story about a homeless child who had died after 8 months of homelessness with his mother. It saddened me, so I live in New England. I got in my car, drove to the airport, flew to New York, and I found the hotel in which this woman had lived while she was pregnant. It's called the Martinique Hotel. It's right near Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. And even then, I don't think I intended to write a book. I was just eager to talk to some of the women and children in that building. But one conversation led to another. I ended up spending New Year's there as well. And by springtime, I'd been there many, many nights, long evenings. And by that point, it seemed that this was a story that ought to be told.
You've described this Martinique Hotel as the saddest place that you've ever been in. Could you first physically describe what the building looks like now?
Sure. It's a 16-story building, 15 occupied floors. The building was once beautiful. At the turn of the century, it was an elegant hotel. It's now a kind of midtown refugee camp in the middle of New York City. You walk into the lobby of the hotel, and you have to pass a guard post, and you face some very hostile guards, some guards that are very tough, and you have to give evidence of the reason you're in the building. And it's hard to provide a good reason. For some reason, people who deal in drugs and a lot of tough people, prostitutes, get into that building. But people who are there for a good purpose find it very hard. And journalists are discouraged from entering the building. If you can get into the building, you might wait for an elevator. If you do, you'll wait a long time. More likely, you'll walk upstairs. If you're visiting someone up on one of the higher floors, for example, the 15th floor, you're likely to prefer walking to the long wait in the elevator. At many points in the past year, there's been no light in the elevator. The elevator sometimes doesn't stop at particular floors. Once you get into the stairways going up, you see a lot of children. You see young children. The average child in the building is 6 years old. And there are a lot of children in that one building. There are 1,200 kids with about 600 parents. 1,200 children. You see a lot of them playing on the stairs. At the landings, you'll see the children playing amongst the garbage. There's a lot of garbage piled on every floor. As you get higher up in the building, you begin to notice the signs which are posted over the elevators at each landing. One sign that I remember vividly tells the people that the fire alarm system doesn't work. If there's a fire, don't expect the alarm to go off. Use a telephone to call the fire department. But of course, the people in this building don't have phones. They don't have kitchens. They don't have anything like that.
What are the rooms like?
Well, the rooms are small, and you'll get a slightly larger room if you have a larger family, but typically you might have a room that's 10 by 12 or 12 by 15 feet, in which you'll see a mother and father with three children. And the average family in the Martinique tends to be a family of four, a family of five. For a family of four, the city pays private hotel owner approximately $2,000 a month. It's very expensive, $24,000 a year. And for a larger family, it can run as high as $40,000 a year. The families don't have kitchens there, and cooking is, of course, forbidden in a hotel in New York City. But the welfare department allocates food allowances on the assumption that families will break the law and cook in their rooms. The food allocation in New York City is called a restaurant allowance, but it's understood that it won't be used in a restaurant. So what happens is that the mother is, or the father, there are many men in that building, are advised very quickly that what they ought to do is go out and buy a hot plate. They bring the hot plate up, plug it in. They do their best to cook a meal on that hot plate, and that's difficult because you can only cook one thing at a time. So if you want to have a meal with your children and your husband or your wife, you might spend 2 hours trying to cook the meal. First, you'll cook the string beans, and then the potato, and if you're lucky, some meat, hamburger, something like that. You eat each thing in sequence. It can take a long time. There are no tables. Rarely are there any tables in these rooms. I've never been in a room that had as many chairs as occupants. So where do you eat? You eat on the floor or on the bed, perhaps. The beds are piled into these rooms. Sometimes there'll be bunk beds, so you might see two or three bunk beds lined up on the walls on either side. Family may have a bathroom of its own, or it may share a bathroom with the next family. The bathroom is also the place where they wash the dishes and prepare the meals frequently. The main impression you get is one of human density. I've never seen people so crowded, impacted might be a more proper word. And as a consequence, a lot of people develop psychosomatic symptoms. Asthma is very common in that building. I've rarely seen a building in which so many people are short of breath much of the time. I found myself after dozens of nights in that building that I began to find it difficult to breathe.
Well, I know that you spoke to a lot of the families there, and you know how a lot of people ended up in this shelter for the homeless, a hotel that is now a shelter for the homeless. What were some of the stories that you heard, one or two of the stories that struck you as being pretty typical ways that families now end up homeless in New York?
Well, every family arrives in a homeless shelter by a different route, but there are some patterns. For example, half the parents in the Martinique Hotel have at some point previously held full-time jobs. Most of these people were not mentally ill. Few were alcoholic. Many of these people are people who have decent education, at least a degree of education. And I also was impressed at the number of couples who remain together despite the difficulty of the shelter system. They're not allowed to remain together often. The rules militate against a man living with his wife, and they frequently have to sneak into the building illegally, which does a good deal of damage to the sense of intimacy within a family. But let me give you an example of one woman. This is a woman, Mrs. Andrews, who had previously held an excellent job. She'd been an accountant I believe, in a law firm. And she'd worked in one job for something like 13 years. She became very ill. This was about 5 years ago. She had to have surgery for cancer, several operations. And she'd been married and had three children. She was living with her husband. In the course of these operations, tension developed with her husband. He went into a depression, and they had to separate. At that point, a single mother with three children, badly debilitated by three successive rounds of surgery, she couldn't pay the rent, and she was evicted. At that point, she landed in the homeless system, and she didn't arrive immediately at the Martinique. The Martinique, bad as it is usually the reward after a long period of migration from one place to another. First, in New York City, she went to a place called the EAU. That's the Emergency Assistance Unit run by the Welfare Department. Then she was sent to a number of short-term hotels, some of which are also used for some of which are also home to prostitutes. One of the hotels she stayed in for a couple of days during that time had no water. She described walking down 14 floors to 42nd Street near Times Square to bring a bucket across the street to a bar to get water to bring up to her room. Finally, she landed in the Martinique in a room which she told me was about 10 by 12 feet, small room. After about 6 months, she was put into a slightly larger room, and that's the room in which I met her. Now, this is an impressive woman. She's well-organized, she's dignified, she writes well, she can type well, she is very good at keeping a budget, but it's terribly hard to survive under these conditions, even with the best organizational skills.
Well, I know one of your fears is that these shelters and the homelessness situation in America is creating a kind of permanent underclass, because it seems to be very difficult to get out of the shelter system once you're in it.
It's almost impossible to get out of the system once you're in it. For example, you can't save money. It would make sense if you're homeless to try to put together a few thousand dollars so that at some point when you see an apartment, you can pay the rent and rent deposit and security. It's illegal for a family in this situation to save more than $1,000. If they do, they'll be cut from welfare. And they learn of this in the most mechanical and intimidating way. They put their card into a cash dispenser, a welfare computer, and they get a printout which says, "No benefits. Your case is closed." I've seen a number of these printouts. When this happens, mothers are terrified because it's 30 days before they can be reinstated. Meantime, they have no benefits. They're likely to lose Medicaid. They lose food allowance for their children. They're at risk of being evicted from the hotel. And their greatest fear is that as a result of these things, their child will be taken from them. And children are taken from mothers because they are homeless, for no other reason, purely because they have no safe domicile. When this happens, the charge against the mother usually is abuse and neglect of her child.
Well, you also describe a situation where once you're on welfare and in the shelter system, you seem to never ever have enough money in your welfare allowance to actually find an apartment large enough to hold
well, that's
a family.
True. That's true. The rent allowance for a family on welfare in New York City, if it's a family of four, a mother and three children, or mother and father and two kids, let's say, family of four, is about $270 a month. Well, it's very, very difficult to find any apartment in New York City for less than $400, and especially an apartment that would house four people. Meanwhile, the city is paying $2,000 a month to keep that family in the Martinique Hotel, and this money is not even going back into the public treasury. It's going to a private hotel owner, and the owners of these hotels tend to be rather unsavory people, many of whom give a lot of money to political candidates during their campaigns in New York City. One of the largest hotel owners in New York, that is, an owner of a chain of welfare hotels, has contributed over $100,000 to political campaigns of people who now make housing policy in New York City. So there's a lot of reason to be concerned about the waste of this money in paying for these squalid rooms. But the real issue is not financial. The real issue is what this is doing to these people. And you know, it's easy to forget that when we speak of the homeless in this case, we're not speaking about winos and bag ladies. We're not speaking about alcoholics in the Greyhound stations. We're talking about children. These are kids. 12,000 homeless children live in the shelter system in New York. 500,000 kids in the United States.
I'm glad you're pointing that out, because in your book you talk about how homelessness has changed in the past few years.
That's quite right. Since 1980, homelessness has changed its character in the United States. It used to be a kind of theater of the grotesque. And that, of course, is the part that we still see. That's the most visible part. That's the homeless alcoholic is the person we see when we walk through Grand Central Station or Penn Station in New York or any other major city. But increasingly in the United States, when we speak of the homeless, we're speaking of children. We're speaking of mothers and children. We're speaking of families. We're speaking of people living in a battered Chevrolet on the outskirts of Denver. We're speaking of a family living in a tent city on the outskirts of Phoenix. We're speaking of families sleeping on the beach in Miami. And we're speaking of 5,000 families in these squalid buildings in New York.
I want to speak with you more about homelessness, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jonathan Kozel, whose new book is about homeless families in America. It's titled Rachel and Her Children. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Jonathan Kozel, you were just discussing how homelessness has changed. Could you briefly capsulize for us why you think homelessness has changed in the past few years? Why the population is different, why there's more women and children who are homeless, why there's so many more people who are homeless?
I don't think it's coincidence that we've seen the sudden explosion of the homeless population, and particularly mothers and children, in the years since 1980. The 1980s have been a period in which the United States appears to have waged an undeclared war on children, on poor children in our midst. Children represent only about a quarter of the population in the United States, but they now represent 40% of all poor people in America. The percentage of poor children in America has doubled from 20% in 1970 to its present level, 40%. During these years, welfare benefits to mothers with children, AFDC, has declined 35%. The government has stopped building public housing. Federal government has backed out of the public housing business. Subsidies for low-income housing have diminished. And the total federal expenditure for housing for poor people in America has dropped from $32 billion to $8 billion in the present fiscal year. The Reagan administration canceled the White House Conference on Children and Youth in 1981 for the first time in this century. That is a conference that's been held once every decade since 1909, but was canceled in this decade. A cancellation which is taken by many children's advocates as a bitter symbol of our revised priorities.
Most of us who live in cities see people living on the streets every day, living on steam vents, living in train stations, sleeping in vestibules. And many of us haven't ventured into homeless shelters. We haven't witnessed life in there firsthand. But it's really difficult now to know how to behave. I mean, your heart is broken as you walk through the streets. You see a lot of people without houses, and you don't know, well, what should you do? Should you offer money? What is the immediate proper way to behave if you're concerned? How do you handle that? Do you find yourself dealing with this on a more political level of just dealing with policy issues, or do you find yourself working on both levels and giving money to people who you encounter on the streets?
Well, I don't see how we can possibly choose. If a child who's hungry asks us for help, I don't see how we can say no. But obviously, the long-term goal is to bring political pressure to bear to address the simple fact that homeless people are homeless for an obvious reason, not because they're crazy, not because they're lazy, not because they're drug addicts or alcoholics or anything else. They're homeless because they're poor people in a rich society which does not provide enough housing they can afford. That's the only important and most obvious and most immediate cause of homelessness in the United States. But I think there's a related point there. When we see these sometimes apparently deranged homeless individuals on the streets, it's very easy for us to generalize and think that characterizes the homeless population. It's most important to realize that those are only the most visible people. The homeless children and their mothers trapped in these modern poorhouses, what some have compared to refugee camps in the middle of New York City, represent the largest and increasing numbers of the homeless, a group that's increasing by 20% every year. What happens to these children has to be understood. If we don't recognize it, we won't do anything about it. A third of the homeless children in the New York City shelters don't go to school. If they do go to school, they're 2 years behind their grade. It's likely they'll sleep during the morning because it's almost impossible to sleep in the shelters. It's likely they'll be hungry and won't be able to concentrate.
What kind of action are you recommending?
I'm recommending urgent federal action to reinstate the $32 billion level for low-income housing assistance that existed when President Reagan came to office. That's an immediate federal priority, and there is legislation on Capitol Hill which would make this possible, but it has not been authorized. A battle is going on right now in the Congress, in the House, and in the Senate, and it's very important that people bring pressure to bear to bring that authorization to completion. Meanwhile, at the local level, there is something else that can be done. Most of our major cities have a large number of vacant units in buildings that the cities themselves own because they've been seized from private realtors for non-payment of taxes and for other reasons. For a modest amount of money, thousands of these units could be rehabbed and made occupable and made suitable for occupants within a matter of 8 months or a year and a half. We have not done this. There are over 60,000 such units in New York City, for example. The renovation of each unit would cost about what we're spending every 2 years in a place like the Martinique Hotel for a single family. That is an immediate practical measure that could be taken right now to house those who are not homeless. But only federal action will prevent the replication of this problem on a much, much larger scale in the next few years.
One of the women, one of the mothers who you interviewed at the homeless shelter, told you how much she hated the song "We Are the World" and the whole campaign to send money to people who were starving in Africa, because she thought that it was blind to how many people were starving in America, starving in your neighborhood. And I was wondering if you felt the same way about that irony.
Sure I do, because these people are right in front of us, but we don't want to see them. And that's exactly what she said to me. That's the woman I called Rachel. I talked with her on New Year's Eve while her daughters were sitting around listening to us, and they shared in that interview. She spoke of that song, and she said, well, maybe our kids should go out in the streets and sing that. You know, we are the world. We live here, too. why is it you have so much interest in people who are far away but won't look at these kids who are right here in America? And she was quite an eloquent woman. She was also a poet. She wrote good poetry. She read from the Bible. She quoted from the Bible. She was a fascinating woman. Her last words to me were these. She said, "Mister, can you get the government to know that we exist?" She said to me, "It's, Mister, it ain't easy to be begging."
Yeah, let me just ask you. You've written about poor children going to badly run schools. You've written about illiteracy in America. Now you're writing about the homeless. There is a common theme to all of that. You're writing about people who have had little and are likely to have little in America. Now, you've described yourself as coming from a privileged background. And I wonder, through the years, how you've dealt with the question of guilt, if guilt has been an issue for you, or if you decided that that was like a kind of pointless, energy-wasting way of reacting to the things that you've had that the people who you've written about have not.
Well, sure, I've lived with a lot of guilt much of my life, and I'm not sure that there's anything irrational about guilt if you live in an unjust world in which some of us can spend in an hour what these children have for nutrition in a month. Perhaps it makes sense to feel a little guilty, but I think what I've tried to do over the years is to channel this emotion into something useful. So I've taught children. I've worked with children. I taught school for many years. I helped to start schools in some poor neighborhoods in Boston. I worked with adults who couldn't read. And it seems to me, it's better to deal in specific practical measures that you can actually do at the local level than to just sit back in despair. Once you know these people face up, and once they're your friends, you really have no choice but to do something. You can't simply write about it and walk away. I don't think you can. I can't, anyway.
So you can't simply write about it and walk away. So what does that mean you'll be doing?
I'll be spending a lot of the next few months traveling around the country, talking to groups that work with the homeless. I'll be doing my very best to rally support for the major national organization that lobbies for the homeless. That's the National Coalition for the Homeless. I'll be urging people to give their support to the local branches of the Coalition for the Homeless. There are branches in every major city, though the headquarters is in New York. And in every city that I can, I'll be urging private business leaders and government leaders to form coalitions to support the local lobbying groups. And I'll also be spending as much time as I can at Capitol Hill trying to make sure that the $32 billion are authorized and put into the pipelines quickly so that some of these children and some of these mothers, like Rachel, can get out of this poorhouse, get out of this refugee camp, and share in some of the things that all the rest of us take for granted.
Well, Jonathan Kozol, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jonathan Kozol, and his new book is about homeless families in America. It's titled Rachel and Her Children. It's published by Crown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with exiled South African singer Miriam Makeba. In her teens, she was a singing sensation in South Africa. In the 1960s, she caught the attention of Harry Belafonte. She became the first African singer to achieve wide success in America. For the past 20 years, she's lived in Guinea, but she returned last year to perform in Paul Simon's Graceland tour. She has a new album and an autobiography. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, rock musician and producer T-Bone Burnett talks about the pros and cons of producing his own new recording after having produced records for Elvis Costello, Los Lobos, and Roy Orbison. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Cho Lang Lin performing Mozart, three works from the brief period in the composer's life when he wrote violin concertos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the words of war, how language has glorified and sanitized modern warfare. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. President Reagan today promised to keep part of a proposed Nicaraguan aid package in escrow until he speaks with the leaders of Central America's democracies. The pledge came during a speech aimed at winning support for the Contra aid request he sent to Congress today. The plan calls for more than $36 million in aid, including $3.5 million in arms and ammunition. He said the lethal aid money would not be spent if the Central American presidents agree that a ceasefire is in place at the end of March. A West German national was kidnapped in Beirut this morning, the third West German to be abducted in that city. The kidnapping seems to be connected to the trial of an alleged Shiite terrorist in Dusseldorf. Deidre Berger reports.
A year ago, two West Germans were kidnapped in Beirut. The kidnappers demanded the bond not extradite to the U.S. the accused hijacker of a TWA jet to Beirut in 1985, Mohammed Hamadi. Currently, his brother Abbas is on trial in Dusseldorf for helping plan the kidnappings. Observers see the abduction this morning of 30-year-old engineer Ralph Schrey as an attempt to pressure the West German government into releasing the Hamadi brothers, or at least letting them off with light sentences. No one has yet claimed responsibility for Schrey's kidnapping, but relatives suspect the pro-Iranian Hezbollah group was behind the abduction. Another Hamadi brother is one of the leaders of Hezbollah. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
The nomination of Judge Anthony Kennedy to the Supreme Court has been unanimously approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The nomination now goes before the full Senate, where a vote could come as early as Friday. The court has been members short for 7 months. Republican Senator Jesse Helms continued his attack today on the medium-range missile treaty, calling it, quote, unequal, unfair, and a trigger for nuclear holocaust. Helms is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which held its third day of ratification hearings today. The committee heard from former Secretary of State William Rogers, who joined the long list of witnesses supporting the pact.
If crippling amendments are attached, or if it dies in its crib from inordinate delay, the chances for arms reductions in this century may have been lost. And the chances for what appears to be a window of opportunity for peace may be closed.
Rogers, who served in both the Eisenhower and Nixon administrations, said the provisions in the treaty calling for on-site inspection would have been considered a miracle during his tenure. At the World Summit on AIDS in London today, U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop said the rapid spread of AIDS by intravenous drug abusers sharing needles may require some controversial remedies. NPR's Lori Garrett reports.
The World Summit on AIDS is addressing numerous ways to control the spread of the epidemic, and a lot of the discussion is focused on intravenous drug abusers who get and spread AIDS by sharing contaminated needles. Delegates from Scandinavian countries spoke at length today about the distribution of sterile syringes to drug addicts. And for the first time, U.S. Surgeon General Koop indicated he might support such an effort in the United States.
My basic principle is that with a fatal epidemic that's spreading as this one is, you do anything in the world that you can do to stop it. And if providing free needles will stop it, that's fine.
Koop says he's not prepared to call for syringe distribution to drug addicts yet, however. The effectiveness of such an approach to controlling the epidemic should, he said, be carefully studied. In London, I'm Lori Garrett.
The gross national product expanded at a rate of 4.2% in the last quarter of the year. But analysts say today's upbeat report from the Commerce Department masks some worrisome trends in the economy. The bulk of the $39 billion improvement came from a sharp rise in inventories held by businesses. The increase from October through December came despite a big slump in consumer spending. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 9.5 points to close at 1911.14. Advances led to declines 6-5. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of two Mozart violin concertos performed by Cho Lang Lin. Lin's instrument is a Stradivarius that was built 68 years before Mozart wrote these concertos.
In 1775, when Mozart was 19, he wrote five violin concertos. They may not be among his most ambitious works, but they're certainly among his most accomplished and gracious. The last three, especially the fifth with its famous Turkish interlude in the Rondo, have found their place in the permanent repertoire. Among violin concertos, they aren't the most difficult or virtuosic, yet they are as hard to bring off in their way as the Brahms or the Tchaikovsky. Mozart scholars have no definitive explanation as to why Mozart had this sudden outpouring in one genre. Who did he write them for? Himself? A friend? His concertmaster in Salzburg? Besides these five concertos, only a single movement and two other concertos that are probably not completely authentic are known to exist. Did he just lose interest in the form? 4 years later, he wrote the great Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola, his greatest work for strings, but it's absolutely one of a kind. CBS has recently issued a lovely CD that includes both the third and fifth concertos and the adagio Mozart wrote at the request of the Salzburg concertmaster to replace the original and simpler adagio of the fifth concerto. Raymond Lepard conducts the English Chamber Orchestra, and the soloist is the 27-year-old Taiwanese-born Cho Lang Lin. If you've heard of Lin at all, Jimmy to his friends, you've probably heard his touching story. When he was 12, his father died and his mother sent him to study in Australia. Within 3 years, it became clear that where he belonged was Juilliard, but he needed an American sponsor. Eventually, he found one. But the real story is in his playing, which is silvery and elegant, thoughtful, but also capable of high energy and wit. He's not afraid to vary his tone, something violin virtuosos don't often do in Mozart. But what's most impressive of all is the unaffected, unself-promoting speaking and singing quality that is usually the sign of a more mature player, if it's ever there at all. Here's the opening of the heavenly adagio of the third concerto. It's like listening to an aria from one of the operas Mozart hadn't written yet. Thank you. Conductor Raymond Lepard, who is best known for his modernized versions of Baroque music, seems quite in his element here, lending unobtrusive but strong and shapely support. The English Chamber Orchestra almost sounds like an original instrument ensemble. Lepard also composed the lively but tasteful violin cadenzas. Over the years, Lin may learn to let himself go a little more, may develop an even greater rhythmic freedom and alertness. But what's most heartening right now is that he seems interested in playing music, not just the violin.
Cho Lang Lin is performing with the Boston Symphony Orchestra January 28th through 30th at Symphony Hall in Boston. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new CBS recording of music by Mozart, performed by Cho Lang Lin with Raymond Lepard conducting the English Chamber Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Texas-bred songwriter, performer, and record producer T-Bone Burnett. Music critic Joe Sasfi described Burnett's songs as grappling with his own life and by extension with that of his generation and his country. Although Burnett is a favorite among many rock critics, he's never broken through to a mass audience. But he's produced records for performers who have, such as Elvis Costello, Los Lobos, and Roy Orbison. Burnett has left most of his own records in the hands of other producers, but he decided to co-produce his new one himself. From his new album, The Talking Animals, here's the song Relentless.
I stand and tremble in the driving rain, while your love rages like a hurricane. Oh, oh, oh. I can't break the silence, but you're still the wind, but I can hear you breathing underneath my skin. Oh, oh, oh. I am defenseless, almost senseless. You are relentless.
On your new record, what did the producer in you want to show off about the performer in you? As a producer, what did you want to show off of your performing style?
Ooh, well, I think primarily I wanted the songs to come across. That's always my main concern as a producer, is to get a performance of the song that does it justice.
Why don't you always produce your own records?
Well, it's difficult. The studio is such a narcissistic place that one can tend to make himself, or want to make himself seem perfect, you know. I feel like you need an objective person there just to say stop, you know.
Let's talk about your work as a songwriter. Are there certain songs that formed your idea of what makes a really good song? Certain songs that you measure everything against?
Yeah, I think You Are My Sunshine probably is, I think, is the greatest song ever written, you know, as a popular song. I think the great songs are things like You Are My Sunshine, where every word is gigantic in it, or All You Need Is Love, You Are My Sunshine, you know. Those words that, those terribly democratic songs that each person can understand and feel.
On one of your earlier records, you recorded Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, the Julie Stein mm-hmm. song.
Uh-huh.
What made you want to record that song? It seemed, I have to say, kind of out of keeping in a way.
Well, you know, I was thinking there was a time in this country when Julie Stein was writing, or Rodgers and Hart, or Cole Porter, when there were popular songs that were literate and funny and smart. And hits as well, and I thought that was really peculiar. You don't see a lot of those sorts of songs today. But that particular song, I thought, this is a really beautiful song, and it still is, and funny, witty, and it still is pertinent today as it ever was, but you tend never to be able to hear it because of the melody is so sort of jaunty or happy or something, you know. So I decided to slow it down and take it out of that thing completely and make a more modern arrangement for it or something.
Yeah, well, you almost totally flattened out the melody.
Yeah, I think I did, in fact.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old. We all lose our charm in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Let's rock.
Did a lot of people think you were trying to trash the song when you recorded it?
I don't think so. You know, Anita Luce, who wrote the book for that show, she heard it and loved it. About a month before she died.
That's great.
I love that song, and I think most people thought it was a fairly loving rendition of it.
How did you start producing records? Because you were producing records back when you were a teenager.
Yeah, I was. You know, we started. We had a local band, to get better jobs or to get jobs at all that paid, we decided to go in and make a record. You know, because you could do that. You could make a record back then for $100 and get it pressed and get it played on the radio. And I fell in love with the process at the time, because it was, you know, that was the beginning of multi-tracking and all the possibilities.
Do you think the role of a producer has changed a lot since you started out when you were a teenager?
It's not a lot. It hadn't changed a lot for me. There are producers these days that have machines. There's a guy, Trevor Horn, who's made some really good records, all with his Fairlight or Synclavier or whatever it is he has, that just comes, you hire him and he basically fabricates a record for you. So there's always been that, and then there's always been the kind of guy like, I don't know, like Alan Lomax, who's just gone down to the field and recorded people, you know. I feel a lot closer to that kind of producer.
You produced the Roy Orbison recording of In Dreams that was used in the movie Blue Velvet. What were you going after in the re-recording of In Dreams?
We were trying to make it as true to the spirit, sort of the spooky spirit of the original record as we could.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, and just a sprinkle stardust and a whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away into magic night. I softly say a silent prayer like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream my dreams of you.
Well, you're producing a new album with him now. I guess it's already produced and the album's going to come out soon. It seems to me that there's a couple of traps you could easily fall into with a comeback type of record. One trap would be to go for nostalgia, and another trap would be to be trendy in the hopes of sounding contemporary. And now, what were you going for in the new record?
Well, my original idea was not to change anything Orbison ever did, but to simply make it sound as big today as we thought it did back when we first heard those early records.
Do you feel that music has ever let you down, that rock and roll has let you down? I know you think of yourself as playing more of pop than rock and roll. But with the way rock and roll has become wedded to show business in a way, do you feel like you've been let down?
Well, I think, constantly, almost invariably, you get let down by it. Because a lot of us had a lot of hopes for rock and roll when we were kids, you know, coming from a very repressed, kind of strange, hypocritical society. We were hoping that there was going to be something different, and there really isn't.
Is there any spirit of rock and roll that you would like to keep in the records that you make of your own and the records you produce of other people?
Yeah, I would like to keep the abandon, the audaciousness of rock and roll. That's the thing that I think is important. I mean, I remember Elvis Presley. I was reading the liner notes to his greatest hits or something that have just been re-released that Greg Geller did. Or no, who did those? I can't remember. Maybe Peter Guralnick, a good writer. And one of the things Elvis said was he was when he was growing up down in Tupelo, he used to listen to a black blues singer down there, and he said he knew that if he could sing with the same emotion and spirit of that guy, that he'd be a music man like the world had never seen. And I think that's what he just finally decided, what have I got to lose? And he cut loose, and you saw what happened, you heard what happened. And I think that's the really wonderful thing about rock and roll, is that sense of abandon.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
T-Bone Burnett's new album, The Talking Animals, on Columbia Records is due out February 8th. Here's the song, Killer Moon.
The talking animals say, when the moon's so big and yellow,
you're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who's hosting the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story is he following?
We're following the controversy over more aid to the Nicaraguan rebels, to the Contras. With the vote on Capitol Hill just a week away, the lobbying for and against is getting very intense. President Reagan made a big speech today on behalf of aid to the Contras, and a group opposed to Contra aid accuses the FBI today of spying on their activities. Also, a report from the occupied West Bank of the Jordan River on a factory where Israelis and West Bank Palestinians had been working together rather well until very recently, until the demonstrations, and what effect those have had on the people there.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Nuclear warfare is probably the most frightening prospect facing the world today, but our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says you wouldn't know it from the language the experts use to describe it.
I've just been reading an intriguing article in a recent issue of the feminist journal Signs, in which Harvard psychologist Carol Cohn recounts a year she spent at the Center on Defense Technology of a major university. Cohn's colleagues there were what she calls the defense intellectuals, the men, evidently they were all men, the men charged with figuring out how to manage the arms race and how to fight a nuclear war if deterrence fails. The defense intellectuals talk about war and death in a private technical language, which has been cleansed of all moral connotation and graphic detail. Low radiation devices are clean bombs, strikes on enemy cities are countervalue attacks, human casualties are collateral damage, and a war that stops short of all-out annihilation is a sub-Holocaust engagement. Now, it's important to realize that this is not an especially recent phenomenon. The sanitization of the language of death and weaponry is one of the hallmarks of modern warfare. It did not begin with the nuclear age or even with the final solutions of Hitler's Germany. In fact, it's worth noting that the Nazis borrowed the term concentration camps from the British, who introduced it during the Boer War at the turn of the century. You often hear it said that this sort of talk reflects the impossibility of dealing directly with the sheer, unimaginable horror of modern war. But war has always been a brutal business. If you think it was once a more gentlemanly affair, you should read contemporary accounts of the devastation that the Crusaders visited on the inhabitants of the cities they sacked in the Holy Land, or take a look at Goya's etchings of the atrocities that Napoleon's troops committed against Spanish civilians. It's true that the slaughter was less efficient in those days, but it was equally unpleasant for those unfortunates who happened to be hanging around Ground Zero. Yet earlier ages did not talk about war with such phrases as unthinkable and indescribable. On the contrary, they often celebrated the excitement of battle in quite literally gory detail. We have a great tradition of English war poetry that stretches back from Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade to the battle poems of the Anglo-Saxon bards, who sang the glories of slaughter in a language that sometimes seems to have had 27 synonyms for disembowel. So why have we become so fastidious in modern times? A lot of people say that this language is a kind of double talk, intended mostly for public consumption, an attempt to defend the indefensible, as Orwell put it. But as Cohn shows, the defense intellectuals aren't particularly interested in making their case to the public. They use phrases like collateral damage and sub-Holocaust engagement, even when talking among themselves. In fact, they're scornful of purely political euphemisms for war and weapons. They would never call the MX missile the peacekeeper, as Reagan does. They prefer to think of it as a damage limitation weapon. The real reason for the new language is not that war has become more brutal, but that it's become less glorious. The Duke of Wellington may have been right when he said that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton, but World War III will be won on the little green screens of Caltech and the Rand Corporation. And with the new warfare has come a new breed of warriors. The modern defense intellectuals didn't grow up leading charges of toy soldiers across the playroom floor, lost in dreams of valor and stirring deeds. They were the kind of kids who preferred chemistry sets or later computers. And I suspect that in their reveries, it was raw intellect that saved the day and won the fair maiden. That explains a lot of the appeal of the new language of strategy, which turns warfare into a wholly rational enterprise, unconfounded by any emotional slobber. Fair's fair, after all. In the old days, men like these were made lowly clerks in the quartermaster corps. Now they're running the show. If the Holocaust ever is unleashed, it will be the revenge of the nerds.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with actor and writer Spalding Gray. He's wrapping up his residency at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by rap star Kool Moe Dee. It's 10 years since rap first appeared, and Ken thinks this might be the album to take hold with the pop music audience. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Dead, John Huston's adaptation of the celebrated James Joyce short story. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.